Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Make Sense with Mental Leap, the show that places power in your hands and information for your mind. Let others leave small lines, but not you. Let others place their future in someone else's hands, but if you listen to the show, you'll make sure it's not you. We'll provide you with the keys, but it's up to you to unlock the door.
Welcome to Make Sense with Mental Leap. I'm your host. Today our topic is the injustice of justice. We will be discussing integrated policing. I have a few superstars with me in the room, but before we get to them, I'd like to thank Reverend Leroy Mitchell and Reverend Joe Mitchell for allowing us to record live at New Hope Missionary Baptist Church. Thank you guys. Again, today we're talking about integrated policing, the injustice of justice. Before we introduce our guest, I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a very knowledgeable individual on policing. And when you want a co-host to deal with policing, there's nobody better than this guy right here, Sergeant Ramon Holler. How you doing, Sarge?
I'm doing fine.
That's good. So take us where we need to go, Ray.
It's my pleasure to sit here and be a co-host on a show where we're going to be talking about integrated policing with none other than Chief Dr. Donald Gray II. For those of you all who aren't familiar with Chief Brady, started his policing career in 1979 with the Rock County Sheriff's Department in Wisconsin. Got his first chief job at Bloomer, Wisconsin in 1988. He is a PhD in administration and management, and he has attended both the FBI Academy as well as the Northwestern School of Police Staff and Command. Chief Grady has been all over the world policing, and he's had many policing jobs from municipalities like Santa Fe, New Mexico, to universities like Northern Illinois University as well as University of New Mexico. And he's also been overseas, lastly, at Kosovo, where he was the deputy police commissioner. If I mess anything up, I'm sure Chief Grady will absolutely correct the record. But this is the individual that we have here today to speak on integrated policing. So thank you very much, and let's get to talking.
Good to be here.
So what's up, Chief? You ready?
I'm ready. I'm always ready.
All right. Well, let's get to it. We're going to delve right into it. So there's a lot going on in the world of policing today. The community thinks the police need to be more accountable. The police think, or on the large scale, we're saying the community needs to understand what we do. So, Chief, can you go ahead and give us a history of policing and then policing in America? And I think that'll take us right into integrated policing.
Well, the notion is somehow the police believe that it's the community that needs to step up, the community that needs to be in tune with the way they police is a wholly faulty notion. The fact of the matter is, we should be more concerned with what is it that the police are doing to actually do what needs to be done to take care of the community. After all, it is the police that serves the community, not the community that serves the police. The bigger part of community policing, which seems to be the buzzword in the last several years, the bigger part of community policing has always been the community. Even in terms of the words themselves, community is always bigger than the police. So we have to recognize that policing has to serve the community, and we have to look at what's going on right now that's causing policing to miss that boat, that not serving the community as the community wants them to be served. Now, I would tell you that it started out wrong to begin with. You see, any system that you're not included in the design of will necessarily exclude you from the benefits of that system. And when you take a look at the American policing system, there were only European American males that were included in the development of that system. It didn't include African Americans. It didn't include Hispanics. It didn't include Native Americans. It didn't include women. It didn't include anybody except European American males. And the system was designed as a point of repression and oppression. It was never designed to be democratic and open as a democratic model. The whole idea was to control what they considered to be the dangerous classes. So we got to control the African population, control the immigrant population and Native Americans. You consider that if it's about control, then it's not about serving. It's not about doing what needs to be done to protect the community, but instead to repress the community, to maintain the status quo. Now, some would think that over the years, we've developed beyond that, and we're no longer in that mode. And I'd say that's just not exactly correct. We're still doing the same repressive things today that we did back then, perhaps not in such a heinous way. But then again, there are instances where it is equally as heinous. So we need to review the whole process of policing and ask ourselves, what are we doing wrong? How do we do it better? Remember now, if we've got a wrong design to begin with, then we're going to continue to do wrong things if we utilize that design. So my suggestion is change the design. We need to reconfigure policing so that it meets the needs of the people it's supposed to serve.
Okay. So what are some of the shortcomings of policing right now as you see it?
Shortcomings of policing. Why don't you ask me instead, what are we doing right? Because there are so many shortcomings that we could spend the next couple of days talking about the shortcomings of policing. The first thing is that police officers think they know everything, that they know how to do everything, and they know it better than the people. So the whole idea is we are the police. We know what you need and how you need it done. And so don't question us. That's a major problem in and of itself. And there's a whole number of things that fall right in under that umbrella. So the idea that somehow we have abrogated our responsibility for policing as citizens to a select few who we call the professionals has been a notion that's long outlasted itself, should never have been there in the first place. We got to recognize that the police have to begin to rely on the people again, because policing is community building. Now, ask any police officer just about in this country what it is that they do for a living, and they're likely to tell you, I'm a law enforcement officer. And they really believe that that's what they're designed to do, law enforcement. Now, in the state of Illinois, the statutes call you a peace officer, not a law enforcement officer. The whole idea of being a peace officer is meaning that you're there to keep the peace, to make the peace, to hold the peace. And we're not doing that. We're just enforcing the law. Enforcement is a function. It's a function of policing, one small part of what policing should be overall. Policing itself is community building, and that's a much larger concept. Policing is a mission, not a function. Law enforcement is a function. Now, of all those things that I've just told you, there's a whole lot of things that you can see in there that are wrong with the system that believes it's already doing everything correctly, when clearly the people that they're serving are in disagreement. You can ask any of the citizens what they think, and I'm talking about minority citizens at this point, because the dominant population is generally happy with policing. And since they're satisfied with the way policing is done, that's one of the things that causes us problems. You have to look at the fact that the dominant population is not put upon in the same way as the lower socioeconomic brackets or minority groups in policing. So if you recognize that, then you recognize that we've got to do some things to meet the needs of all communities, not just the dominant society.
Well, if I may, Chief, to expound a little bit, what do you think keeps the, I understand that policing is not done in the same way in the dominant society or dominant culture as it is in minority communities and lower socioeconomic communities. But I guess my question would be, what do you think keeps the dominant society from making changes to the system so it benefits everybody?
Because it works for them. For the dominant society, policing is working very well for them. They're satisfied with what they're getting, but that's because they're treated differently. If you go to the minority communities, you will see that they suffer over-policing and under-policing to a great degree. That same type of policing is not done in the communities of dominance. For example, New York implemented what they call the stop and frisk doctrine. And they just stopped people for what they considered to be small things. And then they searched those people and looked at those people to try to find out if there's something going wrong that they can take action on. And they claimed that that was a broken windows theory. Well, I think that they misunderstood what broken windows was about to begin with. I don't think broken windows ever meant for you to go around and stop everybody. But two, that's unconstitutional. It was never constitutional for them to just stop people at random of their own accord with them having done nothing wrong. There is a stop and frisk agenda, and it's called Terry versus Ohio. But the idea then is that you have to have a reasonable suspicion that something is illegal being done, or something is about to be done or has been done that's illegal. But it can't be that you just say, you know what, I want to stop this person randomly. Now, you don't use those same kinds of tactics in the dominant society. You cannot go into dominant American upper level suburban neighborhoods and find the police using the same tactics as they do in minority neighborhoods. And so that would bring me to another point that I'm sure we'll discuss a little later on. But the idea is policing should be done judiciously and fairly across the board. If that were happening, I don't believe you'd have any dissension in the minority neighborhoods right now. The reason you have dissension in minority neighborhoods is because the process, the system is unfair. It was never designed to meet the needs of minorities, and so it can't, and it does not meet the needs of minority. We need a new system.
When you talk about, or you talked about a little bit earlier, about the police needing to get back to the community, that reminds me a little bit of, and obviously for those who don't know, I worked for Chief Grady for 12 years, and part of what he had me do is research and read Sir Robert Peel's principles. And that one reminds me of Sir Robert Peel, the police of the people of the police. Can you kind of, you just touched on it a little bit, but expound a little bit more on how that dynamic actually works?
Well, how that dynamic should work.
Right.
Because it's clearly not working right now. The idea was that every citizen has an obligation to work on maintaining the peace of the community, to work on building that community. That way, the police are the public are the police. However, somewhere along the line, because we were never in this country built off of Sir Robert Peel's principles. In this country, the whole idea was policing was about keeping people down, maintaining control over a particular segment of society. When Sir Robert Peel came up with that rule, he was thinking that we have to figure out how are we going to work best with the public, recognizing that the public also needs to be able to work with us. One of his key principles was to make certain that policing in the metropolitan area was not militarized. In fact, he went to great lengths to ensure that policing was not militarized. However, if you take a look at policing in America, they are becoming more and more militarized with every passing year. We get more and more military equipment, more and more military armament, more and more military rhetoric and ideas and strategies, and we've lost the idea that this is a free and democratic society and we should be finding ways to build communities, not somehow to oppress communities. I heard a statement not too long ago that said, lions don't care for the opinions of sheep. And if lions don't care for the opinions of sheep, I'm trying to figure out which one of us is the lion and which one is the sheep. So if we somehow think that the police are lions, when did the public become their prey? And why is it we wouldn't care for the opinions of sheep? Why would we not see ourselves rather as a protector of the sheep? As Sergeant Holland would say, we're the sheep dog. Why are we not seeing ourselves as the protector of the sheep as opposed to the sheep being our prey? In fact, if you look at the tactics being used in minority neighborhoods now, you can see that that's exactly how they see it. I'm a law enforcement officer, so I'm going to use pretext to stop people so that I can enforce the law. Well, my idea is, why are you using a pretext? If you have a legitimate reason to stop a vehicle, then you don't need a pretext. Pretext is created so that we can circumvent the Constitution. Fact of the matter is, you're supposed to be able to move around in this country freely. And if you have a car or are driving a car, there's an assumption being made, and it should be made by every police officer, that you have a driver's license, that you have the authority to drive that car, that you are not suspended, and that you are abiding by the rules unless they see some reason to believe that you are violating the rules. If I believe in that, then I don't need text to stop you. And then we wonder why people think that we're profiling. Well, come on. If you stop me and say, look, You didn't turn your left-hand turn signal on 100 feet before you got to the intersection. Instead, you turned it on 25 feet from the intersection, and that's why I stopped you. I'm not believing that you stopped me because of any wrongdoing on my part as it relates to that left-hand turn signal. You stopped me for another reason. Now, unfortunately, the U.S. Constitution, not the U.S. Constitution, the Supreme Court has now said it's okay. If you don't like what you see in the vehicle, if for any reason, if you can find any motor vehicle violation, then you can stop that vehicle and it's okay. That is an end run around the Constitution. You see, because we also have a law that says you cannot discriminate. You cannot use race as a reason to discriminate. You cannot use gender as a reason to discriminate. You cannot use sexual preference as a reason to discriminate. But if I allow to use pretext as a way to stop a vehicle, then it doesn't make any difference what my initial reason for stopping the car was. I can use the pretext to get it done. Now, my question would be, why did you want to stop the car in the first place? If it's driving down the road and there's nothing illegal that you see being done, I mean blatantly illegal, that's going to jeopardize the safety and security of the motoring public, if there's nothing there, why do you need a pretext? What would make you want to stop that vehicle? And it can only be based on what you see. And if what you see causes you to want to stop that vehicle, that in and of itself says you're discriminating. That is a problem. We've got to uphold the Constitution, not find ways to end-run the Constitution. And who is it that becomes victims of pretextual stops? Minorities. Because we're not using pretext to stop European Americans. And that is a real fallacy. You will hear cops over and over again talk about the guns in the neighborhood. We got to get the guns out of the neighborhood. But who has more guns than the dominant population in this society? If you want to find guns, stop some of the European Americans driving down the road and you'll find most of them have a gun in the car. There's a preponderance of people carrying guns that are not minorities. So why are we using pretext to stop minorities instead of stopping all the vehicles that we think might have a gun in them? And it's because the system was designed to be repressive. It was designed to be oppressive. And there's a certain category of people, a certain segment of the population that it was designed to control. And they continue to control it that way today.
What do you say then, Chief, to all those hundreds and thousands of law enforcement officials and practitioners who say that pretext and the like are extremely effective tools that need to be used, that are necessary in order to impact the crime that's happening in communities?
The first thing I would tell them is go look at the stats, because the stats don't bear that out. The stats don't show you that it's an effective tool to do anything. It shows you that you can make a lot of stops. You can stop a lot of people and you can detain those people for a period of time. But you're not finding that the number of stops that are being made based on the number of arrests that are actually made for legitimate crimes having been committed would justify that number of stops. One of the things about America that makes it so special is freedom. Freedom to move, freedom to speak, freedom to be free. The problem is, when you start using pretext, you take that freedom away. I believe, personally, that you should never, ever, ever stop anybody without having a legitimate public safety reason for making that stop. Because otherwise, you're infringing on the freedom of that person. And that freedom is the thing that I hold most dear about America. And I should never infringe on another person's freedom, even for a moment, out of speculation. And since when did race become a crime or become suspicious? Because that's what we're doing when we use pretext. Ah, he's suspicious. And I just love it when cops tell me he matched the description of an armed robbery suspect. So he's driving down the road. You look in the car and he matches the description of an armed robbery suspect. And what made him match that description? Well, he was a black male. How many black males do we have in the city? How many black males do we have in the county? How many do we have in the state? So you can't use black male as a bona fide descriptor to say he looked like an armed robbery suspect. Give me something else. Well, what can you see? When you're looking in the car, what do you see? A neck and a head. So how do you get that? Because you don't have any height. You don't have any weight. You don't have any build. You don't have any real color of eyes. You don't have color of hair. You don't have anything other than black male. And most black males have black hair and brown eyes, most of them. So Who are we now stopping? Any black male could match that description of an armed robbery suspect if all you're looking for is a black male. Do we do that with European Americans? When Timothy McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma Mural building, did we stop every white male driving down the road so that we could determine whether or not this was the person that was guilty of blowing up the Oklahoma Mural building? And the answer to that question is a resounding no. And why? Because it would have been wholly unreasonable to stop everybody based on a description of white male. And all you can see in that car is from the shoulders up. So I don't know if this guy matches the description or not. And we need to stop listening to the police give us that rhetoric, expecting us to buy it whole heart. He matched the description. Let me give you a quick example. You see, I was stopped once for matching the description of armed robbery suspect. I was draped over the hood of a car, gun was put to my head, and I was told not to move, otherwise my brains would end up on the ground somewhere. I'm complying. I'm laying across the hood of this car. Now, understand, I was coming from the home of my drummer. I was trying to be a rock and roll star at the time. And so it's like 3 o'clock in the morning or so, and I'm coming from the home of my drummer. Now, what makes this unique is I was punk before punk was punk. So I was walking around at 6'5", 225 pounds, in 3-inch platforms, wearing a 3-inch mohawk on the top of my head. Now, they had me draped across this car, and they had turned on the PA system so that they could hear what was going on without having to rely on the radios, because at that time you didn't have the little mics that clipped to your collar. So you either had to turn your radio up real loud, you know, and everybody didn't want the radios up real loud, so they just put it over the PA. And then they decided to announce the description of the armed robbery suspects, plural, over the PA. And they were looking for two white males, somewhere in the neighborhood of 5'8 to 5'10, about 160, 170 pounds, blonde hair, blue eyes. And my question was, how in the heck do I match that description? But that's the excuse. You match the description. 6'5", 225 pounds, black man with a mohawk, and you tell me I match that description. Do you think that if I had robbed the station that the guy would have said it was a black man with a mohawk? Because there were so many of us walking around. In fact, at that time, there was only one of us walking around that looked like that. How did I match that description? I didn't. But I can say that as a police officer, and everybody will buy it because there's no way to refute it. The one guy that can refute it is the guy that's being held, but you're not listening to him anyway. And the public, in the absence of having a videotape of the incident, won't believe it. So I matched the description. When I called and complained, they basically told me, well, you know, mistakes happen. Tell me how that was a mistake. What they were telling me is, we don't care and we're not going to do anything about it. We can discriminate against you with impunity. Why? Because the dominant population will say it's okay. To take a look at what's happening in America today, all of the black men that we see being shot and killed, the people of color being shot and killed by police officers. And I have to ask myself, how do we do this and let it get away with that? And it always goes to the grand jury, and the grand jury never comes back with a true bill. They never come back and say he's indicted. And my question is, why would that be? And it's a simple thing. The cops were hired to do a certain job. And that job is being done against a minority community, by and large. The dominant community is not affected by that. The grand juries are, by and large, made up of people from the dominant community. So when, in fact, some of those dangerous classes, those people in the dangerous classes are stopped, and they're accosted by the police, and even if they're killed by the police, when you take that before the dominant portion of society on the grand jury, they never find anything wrong, because as far as they're concerned, the police must have done it right. And the police use a guilt factor to make us believe that, because they will tell you right after that shooting, we put our lives on the line for you every single day. If I hear that one more time, I think I will throw up in my mouth. The fact of the matter is, that's a ridiculous thing to say. I've been in policing for 37 years, and I don't put my life on the line every single day. Now, there are times when I have to put my life on the line, and it's seriously on the line. But by and large, my life is not on the line every single day. However, my reputation is, and I believe that it's important for me to maintain my reputation. And how do I do that? I treat everybody fairly, consistently, and equitably. If we did that, you would find that the problems we have in the minority neighborhoods right now would disappear, because the minorities are not asking for anything special. They just want to be treated fairly. And when they see a police officer that manages to shoot down an unarmed black man and says that he was fearful for his safety, and then we get the grand jury to say, we didn't see anything wrong, they're outraged. And why? Because the cops will tell you, look, you can't make any decisions until we have done a complete and thorough investigation. We have to investigate this to make certain that all sides are treated fairly. But if it happened to be a minority that were to kill someone, and Lord, don't let it be a cop, but if they kill someone, the first thing you hear the cops say is, we've got to bring this person to justice, and we need to bring them to justice right now. We need to get out there and find this person, and we need to get this done. Well, why aren't you doing that with the cops? Why is it when a cop shoots somebody, we got to be fair and take our time and evaluate this thing, and we can't believe what we see on the video because we didn't see everything? But if it's a minority, then we got to bring this person to justice immediately. It's that type of rhetoric that makes minorities understand themselves to be less than full-bodied American citizens. We're something less. We don't count. We're still three-fifths of a human being. And I don't understand how it is that an American society, as educated and as intelligent as we are today, will buy into that and let somebody guilt you into believing that you have to accept the argument that I was fearful for my safety as justification for shooting an unarmed person. You see, the Supreme Court once again said that the standard for using lethal force is you gotta have this whole idea of imminent danger of death or great bodily harm. Imminent danger of death or great bodily harm. Now that means right this second, right at this very instant, I believe that if I do not use deadly force, I will either lose my life or somebody else will lose their life, or we will have loss of limb by either me or somebody else, but it's imminent danger of death or great bodily harm. Now, if you don't see a weapon, if he doesn't have a weapon, how do you argue to me that you were in imminent danger of death or great bodily harm? But we don't use that as a standard anymore. Now we've decided I'm fearful for my safety. Now, one other quick thing I'm going to say about this, and that is if we have all of these officers walking around that are fearful for their safety and they believe they have to take the lives of innocent black people that do not have weapons, or innocent black children that have toy guns because they didn't recognize it as a toy gun and used poor tactics when they drove up on the person so that they were scared, perhaps they should not be police officers. Not everybody is cut out to be a police officer. And many of the people that we're hiring today fall into that category. They fall into the ilk of you should never have been hired as a police officer. You don't have the intelligence. You don't have the integrity. You don't have the commitment. You don't have the dedication. And we've got to change that. Now, does that mean that all officers fall into that category? The answer is no. But I'm not going to engage in the same kind of rhetoric that most people engage in and say, look, we got all of these good cops. Most cops are good cops. So you can't paint them with this big, broad brush. And I'm going to tell you, look, how many times have we seen that one bad cop shoots a person, kills a person that didn't have a weapon, and the other six officers that were at the scene write reports that substantiate what this person did, and then you find out later on that they all lied. Now, they will all tell you that those other six officers were good officers. The one bad officer is the one that pulled the trigger, and I tell you, wrong. You can't be a good officer if you allow bad things to happen, illegal things to happen, and take no action. So if you stand by and do nothing, then you're just as guilty as the person that did it. One other quick thing, and that is, if you've got six people involved in dealing with an individual, and all six of them end up killing that individual, such as if we talk about the gentleman in New York that was choked to death. All of those cops were involved. We charged one. They tried to charge one person because he used a chokehold. But every single one of those cops were involved. They were all on him. If that had been a civilian that had did the same thing, every single civilian involved in that matter would have been charged as a party to a crime. Every single one of them. The cops knew what they were doing was wrong. And they did it anyway. Every single one of them should have been charged and held responsible for what it is that they did. And until we have that kind of accountability, the people will not trust the police. They will not trust law enforcement. We have to do better. And that means we have to own up to the fact that we are not policing the way we should. We are not policing fairly.
You know, you spoke a little bit about police, good cops, versus the number of good cops on the street versus the small number of bad cops. And it's been my experience, my belief, that that's a distractionary tool. It allows us to keep doing things the way that we have always done them while distracting the population or garnering support for something. It doesn't need to be supported. It's really a systemic problem in that, and I'll use an example. I can buy all the best ingredients, but if I apply those ingredients to a horrible recipe, my dish is going to taste bad. I think that what ends up happening is you can have all the good cops in the world, but the system of policing is wrong. It's bad. And that's why we come up with, well, you can have all the best well-meaning cops, I'll say, but they can't be good because the system is bad. And that brings me to the next point, systems. For those of you all who don't know, Chief Grady is also an author, and he's wrote an absolutely phenomenal book that you all should read, The Injustice of Justice. Part of the reason that we had this podcast, Menelik Shaw decided to have the podcast, was to get Chief Grady to talk about integrated policing. It's a revolutionary idea. It's a great idea. And I think that while we've highlighted a lot of the problems in policing thus far in this podcast, I think that understanding exactly what integrated policing is and how it can be implemented as part of the solution that we need in order to get policing in the right way. So if you would, Chief Grady, if you take a moment just to very briefly for those of us who are listening that don't necessarily have a huge understanding or a working understanding of integrated policing, explain to us what it is.
Okay. Before I explain exactly what integrated policing is, let me give you a disclaimer here. Because I'm certain that there are a few people out there right now saying that this is a radical guy and he hates police. Everything he's saying is anti-police. And I want to tell you, I dedicated my life to the profession of policing. I have spent 37 years of my life doing what it is that I love and what I care about because my job is to take care of people and to build communities. But in order for me to really be true to what it is that I know, I have to be willing to criticize the very profession that I'm a part of so that we can improve that profession. If we pretend as if we don't have any shortcomings and we continue to work in the same way that we have, then we can't possibly do what's reasonable and right to take care of the public as a whole. So understand, nobody loves policing more than I do. But I love policing, not law enforcement. Law enforcement is a tool I use in order to help to build the community. It's a small part. It's an ancillary part of what policing should be about. Now, that takes us into this whole idea of integrated policing. Community policing over the years has become the buzzword. And it's an amazing thing because you can talk to any chief of police in this country and he can give you an idea of what community policing is. And most of them can use that rhetoric pretty effectively. The problem is, while they understand how to use the rhetoric, they don't necessarily understand how to do the job of community policing. So what you'll find is we change a nameplate on a door, tell this person that you are now a community policing officer, and you got one guy running around the streets in the city trying to convince people that we're better about policing because I got one person out here that will now try to be a representative for the department and be nice. He'll say nice things. He'll do nice things. He'll smile at you. He becomes officer friendly for everybody. That's a wrong answer. Community policing was always meant to affect the entire community, and not just that the police will go out and try to do things with the community, but understanding that once again, community is the bigger part of community policing, that they enlist the support and the help of the community to help build that community. Now, integrated policing does community policing, but it's community policing personified. While you look at community policing as an idea, as a concept, and many people have ascribed it to programs, integrated policing is a prescription for how to go about actually doing the better part of community policing, making things happen, understanding that the public has to be involved. We write policies and procedures all the time in the police department, but we write them unilaterally. We do it ourselves because we think nobody else out there understands what policing should be about. And I'd have to remind them that the whole concept of policing was designed, that is, other than what we do here in America, the idea was that it takes the reasonable person approach. A reasonable person. So take any reasonable person and how they would have handled the situation, and that should be how the police handle the situation. Real. That doesn't take a group of geniuses. A reasonable person should be thinking. Clearly, we have that's not the case. That the only people that understand how to do policing are the police. And I want to go, how did that happen? How did we lose the reasonable person approach to policing? The idea of integrated policing is recognizing that every single issue in this community is a public safety issue. We spend a lot of time in our communities arguing about the pie, the money, who gets what money. Parks and Recs want their money. Streets want their money. The police want their money. Fire departments want their money. They all want their money. And I say, what's wrong with us? We have divided up into teams where we're fighting each other for the pie. But the fact of the matter is, every single issue in the city is a public safety issue. If we look at it as a public safety issue, then we're no longer fighting for the piece of the pie. What we're fighting for is what's best for the public safety of the community overall. What needs to be addressed first? Where are our priorities? So that we stop fighting for a piece of the pie and start fighting to make the community better. And somebody will say, well, now how is that? Well, let's take a pothole. We have a major pothole in the street. Car goes over the pothole, damages the rim, tire goes flat. I now have a person on the side of the road that needs assistance. They need a tow truck or they need somebody to come and help them. And while they're on the side of that road, are they vulnerable? The answer to that question would be yes. They're vulnerable. As long as they're on the side of the road and they can't move and they got to be there with a damaged car, they are vulnerable. Is that a public safety issue? It absolutely is. And what should I be doing as a police officer? First of all, if I get there, I need to help them get their car back together. But more than that, I need to see that there's a pothole here and make certain that we get it fixed. Why? That's a police issue. We have a pothole. It's a policing issue. It's not a street issue. It's a policing issue. Let's fill the pothole. Do what we can. Set up some barricades. Make certain that nobody else goes over that pothole until we can get it fixed. And prioritize that so that we don't jeopardize the safety and security of our public based on a pothole. Now, when you get to minority neighborhoods and lower socioeconomic neighborhoods, you'll find that nobody's tending to the potholes. Nobody's looking at those things that are causing our public to be unsafe. Instead, they're going to worry about the pothole in the affluent neighborhood because they're inconvenienced. They don't want that pothole, and the streets need to be a lot nicer. We need to be fair across the board and recognize that all of our citizens are important. Now, do we have bad people in society? The answer to that question is yes, we do. And those are the people we need to deal with. But 92%, 93% of the population are good, law-abiding citizens that will never have a negative contact with the police, and that includes those in the lower socioeconomic neighborhoods and in the minority communities. If we treat them all as if they're felons, that's an in-service and an injustice to the greater community. We need to recognize that all of these things tie together. Jobs, schooling, you know, what are we doing with driver's license? What are we doing to people and making their lives miserable because we're not thinking about how they're affected? Simple things like we use a pretextual stop to stop a car. That's inappropriate in and of itself. But once we stop the car, we find out that the person didn't have insurance, no proof of insurance. So we write the person a ticket but no proof of insurance. Down the road, he gets suspended because he couldn't prove that he had insurance. He doesn't know he's been suspended because the state won't call you and tell you, oh, by the way, we're going to suspend your license because you don't have proof of insurance. So he's suspended. Now we use another pretext to stop this individual. And when you use a pretext to stop him, you find out not only does he not have proof of insurance, but he's been suspended. So now we take him to jail and we impound his car. And why? Because he didn't have enough money to buy insurance. We created a circumstance that said you have to have insurance. But I don't have the money to buy the insurance that you want me to get. And so now I have to go to jail because I didn't have the money to buy insurance. Now I don't have a license, so I can't drive myself to the little job that I had in the first place. So now I can't make the money that I need to make to even get the insurance. So how are we helping community? How are we building the community if we're hurting it by making certain that those people in the community can't even get to work? Integrated policing says that we need to analyze what's going on in the system and recognize that we have to fix each and every component of that system, using the people in that community to do it. Instead of deciding unilaterally that we know better what should be done for the public, and the public using the police as surrogates for all of their crime and social disorder issues, we need to make absolutely certain that we're doing the things that are right and making certain that we cover the people and that we're doing the things that are right. Integrated policing will take all of those things into consideration, and it does give the responsibilities to police to know how to deal with them. And some people will say, well, we're asking the police to do too much. And I say, no, we're asking them to do too little. The fact of the matter is the police have to be better about what they're doing. They can identify the problems, and when they identify them, they have an obligation to try to do the things that need to be done to fix the problems. Otherwise, we continue with the problems. It should be prevention, not apprehension. If we can prevent things from happening, then we don't have to worry about catching the bad guy on the backside. But if all we're doing is law enforcement, it's all about catching the bad guy, finding a way to trap the bad guy, then we're not doing anything to prevent the crime and stop it from happening in the first place. And if I were to ask you a simple question, and I'm going to ask the host of the show this simple question, I can tell you that I can stop a rape from happening. Your mother is going to be raped unless I do certain things. But I can prevent it. If I do these things, I can prevent the rape. Or we can let the rape happen, and then we can try to figure out who did it after the fact. Which approach do you want me to take?
I want you to prevent it.
Absolutely. And any reasonable thinking person would want me to prevent it. So why is it we don't try to prevent more crime? Instead, we want to try to figure out who did it after the fact. And that's a lousy way to do policing. If you take a look at burglaries, the FBI stats will bear out that only somewhere between 88 and 92% of burglaries in this country will ever get solved. I mean, will go unsolved. So that means that we're looking at somewhere between 12 and 8% that will be solved. All of the rest are unsolved. So if we've got 90% of the burglaries being unsolved, then we can draw the conclusion ourselves that trying to figure out who done it might be an interesting and clever game idea, but it absolutely makes for lousy policing. Integrated policing deals with this on the front side. Prevent it, don't let it happen, so that we don't have a victim. You don't have to figure out who did it after the fact. Instead, you don't let it happen to begin with. It takes a different type of policing and a different type of attitude. It takes a different measurement. We can't use arrest and incarceration as the measurement of good policing. How many people did you arrest? How many felony convictions did you get? How many traffic tickets did you write? Those are erroneous measurements. They don't tell us anything. We need to change the system of measurement so that we can then start doing policing in a reasonable way. And we've got so many incidences of crime out there so far that we can certainly determine whether or not we're doing a better job of policing or not by looking at whether or not the crime stats drop and they get to a point that we now find it acceptable and we don't have to continue to worry about can we catch the bad guy after the fact.
That's an interesting idea of an acceptable limit of crime. But so we've talked about briefly integrated policing, but I want a real life application. You have so many minority communities, south side of Chicago, what's happening up in Milwaukee right now, where you have a lot of violence, a lot of drug use, or a lack of education. And policing has shown itself to be an ineffective way of dealing with any of these things, the current state of policing. How do I integrated policing to these places in order to turn around what's happening and make them a better place to live for all the residents who want their communities to be safe?
It starts with the people. It starts with understanding that the police are representatives of the public and that their whole job is to understand what the needs of the public are. You see, we have this notion that we know best. So we'll focus our time figuring out how to stop or how to investigate a homicide while we've got people dying on the highways every day because we've got stop signs that are covered by trees and people can't see them, or that we've got traffic laws that are not being followed that should be followed, or that we're spending our time doing pretextual stops when somebody else is doing something inappropriate on the other side of town. But we didn't bother to ask the public, what do you need? And you'll find that the public's idea of what they need will be vastly different than what the police think they need. So it starts with us being smart enough to ask the people, and that is ask all segments of society. What is it that you need? What do you need from me? What do you need me to do? And then when they tell you what they need you to do, you have to sit down with that group of people and develop strategies for handling those problems that they have identified as being problems. Now, that doesn't mean that we abrogate all responsibility now to the citizens and that we don't do anything of our own accord. We certainly need to be smart enough to take initiatives to do things to prevent crime that perhaps some members of the society hadn't identified. But we still have to recognize that the bigger part of policing falls with the community, not with the police.
That kind of looks like a sort of a la carte police department or police community interaction, where policing doesn't look the same in DeKalb necessarily as it does in Sycamore because the needs of the communities are different, and therefore we're going to tailor our response and our service to what the community needs. Is that correct?
It's absolutely correct. And you have to recognize that when you consider policing, how would you police every community in the same way? See, because when you take a look at policing on the north side of Chicago, the way you police and the policing requirements are going to be vastly different than if you happen to be on the south side of Chicago. And so you really need to take a look at what does this community need, because the needs are different. For anybody that has children, they will tell you that none of their children are exactly alike. What will work with one child won't work with another child. And they grow up in the same house. They eat the same foods. They go to the same schools. They go to the same church. They understand the same language. They got the same parents. But they're very different in how they respond and how they react to things. And so a good parent will work with each of those children according to the things that that child needs to ensure their appropriate development, and not try to use a one-size-fits-all doctrine to say, nope, because it worked for Johnny, it'll work for Jane. You want to go, wrong answer. What works for Johnny won't necessarily work for Jane. You've got to figure out what it is that we need to do in this society in order to help make it more productive, and then tailor the program to that particular area. And when you look at big cities, the fact of the matter is there are lots of separate neighborhoods all requiring separate ways of doing policing, and we're trying to do them all in the same way. And then we wonder why it's ineffective. Well, it's ineffective because we're still working in an antiquated system, for one, and two, we're trying to make that one size fits all. Well, if you happen to have a size 14 foot and I give you a sock that was made for a size 10, you got a problem. It's not quite covering the foot and the ankle and the leg that you needed to cover. So I need to make a sock that will fit that 14 foot and not give you a sock that fits a size 10 because one size should fit all. Or make one size that now will fit a size 14 foot and expect a guy with a size 8 to be able to wear it. Somehow or another, it's just not going to work. One size fits all does not work in policing. And we have to get away from that and allow ourselves to do things that are appropriate for the individuals that we're working with, the individual communities.
Let's, as we're talking about integrated policing, one area we need to discuss within that is policies, hiring, and training. So I know when I went to the police academy, we were taught, it was ingrained in us for 12, 13 weeks, that the community is out to get you. The people are going to kill you. Every scenario we did, they were fighting or somebody was jumping out of the car. So it's no wonder why when officers get back to their departments, they believe that. And then it's reinforced. And within that department, when I came and worked for you, we were taught that that's not how it goes here. And we were in a lot of trouble if we treated the community bad. So in integrated policing, what are the best policies, best hiring practices, and training to produce the best officer and best police department?
Okay. There's a lot in that. But let's start out with the training issue, and I'll tell you why I want to start with training, because it's a sore point with me when you consider that whenever we have an officer shooting, an officer shoots an unarmed person, the answer to that is we need to train our people better. We need better training. And I'm saying, Let's think about that for a second as logical people, okay? Let's just not accept, once again, this guilting that the police do to us. And so we just accept that they told us that if we train the people differently, if we give them better training, they will act better. So if it were truly a training issue, then wouldn't we expect all segments of the society to end up with the same types of numbers as we do in the minorities communities? So if it were a training issue, since all police officers are trained the same, they all had the same training, so every police officer in that department got the same basic training, why is it that the people in the middle, upper middle, and affluent segments of the society aren't being shot or being abused with excessive uses of force and pretextual stops as the minority community? Why would that be? Because if it were a training issue, everybody would be affected in the same way. So it can't be that it's a training issue, because I'm not looking at a guy driving down the road in a Mercedes being pulled out of his car and tased and beaten unmercifully by police officers. I have not seen any European American males driving BMWs that have been shot in the car while they're sitting in the seat, giving you fair warning that I have a weapons permit, I am armed, and now I'm reaching for my license. I don't see that European-American male being shot in the front seat of his car while his girlfriend sits on the other side in the passenger seat and his baby is in the back seat. Those things aren't happening, but you're telling me that that's a training issue. My question is, how so? Because if it was a training issue, it wouldn't be black people. It wouldn't be Hispanic people. It wouldn't be minority people that are suffering that. We find it right across the board. I would have an example of that European-American male driving that nice new BMW done the same way. But he's not, because it's not a training issue. We know how to treat people. We just choose not to treat minorities and people with less money the same as we do the upper class. That is a system issue. That is an attitudinal and behavioral issue. That doesn't have anything at all to do with training. It has something to do with the system that we're working in and what we find acceptable and what we will accept in policing and what the society will accept. So we need to get off of that easy excuse thing and say, oh, we just need better training. You don't need better training. You need better officers. You need to hire. So now we'll talk about your hiring. You see, we've been hiring for years, the same caliber of person that we hired when we were doing the slave patrols. That's how policing started out in Charleston, South Carolina. Slave patrols, immigration control. We didn't want the Irish to do certain things, so we're going to oppress them. That's who we hired. And we keep hiring that same type of people. Well, this is 2016. It wasn't appropriate back in 1816, but it is even less appropriate in 2016. What we need to do now is look for the person that's more cerebral. That person with the high school education of the GED, we expect them to read, understand, interpret, and apply the statutes in an uncommon way. When the statutes were written for people that have at least 3 years of education beyond the undergraduate level, which means that that guy with a high school education or GED isn't likely to understand those statutes in the same way that the person that has more education is likely to understand them. And the statutes get more complicated every year. We need to hire more educated people, and we need to hire thinkers, not just people with educations, but people that think. And we need a diversity in the people that we hire. And I am not talking about color here. I am not talking about we need to hire more black people or we need to hire more Hispanics. Because you can hire all the black people and all the Hispanics in the world. And if they assimilate into the dominant culture, then all you have is the dominant culture reassimilated and the people walking around with just black skins. That's the only thing that makes them different, with brown skins. We've got to understand that we need to hire different types of thinking, different types of ideologies, people with a broad range of ideas and concepts and thinking about things differently. That's what makes us better, so that we can find that we can have police officers that can identify with just about anybody. Training is okay. I think that our training, if we look at it reasonably, if we use the training that we're getting without the things that we're using now to use excessively force and teaching all the force tactics and the use of firearms tactics, but start teaching some things that make more sense. One of those things being, we need to teach officers how to improvise. when you walk into a situation that you haven't had to deal with before, you might know how to be a cop, but you might not know how to deal with that particular circumstance. But if you learn how to improvise, how to think, you know, in a way that allows you to make decisions and to do things spontaneously, you will be a much better officer. If you learn how to improvise, if you don't know how to improvise, then you get lost and you go back to the things that you have learned by rote and the things that you know best, which means if I have my high school education or a GED and I'm talking to a guy that's got a master's degree and he happened to be beating me up verbally, the thing that I'm going to fall back on is my ability to fight, my ability to use a nightstick, my ability to use mace, because I want to control. And that's what they're telling you all the time. Meet force with like force or greater force. Always maintain control. Well, control is an illusion. It's an absolute illusion. And what we need to do is find a way to manage circumstances appropriately. Management we can do. We can manage, but we cannot control. And so if we begin to think in those lines, teach the officers how to manage the circumstance, how to improvise in those circumstances, how to use their heads so that they can get the best results we're going to do by far better. All of that being a part of what we do with integrated policing.
You say improvise. I think another very important trait is empathize. So many police officers look at the people in which they encounter as less than, criminals, not deserving of empathy. And I think that if, in fact, we get to a point where we can empathize with one another, especially as a police officer to a citizen, we'll be find ourselves in a much better place as well. We all know that crime, as it takes place, is not an entity in and of itself. There are factors that contribute to it. So in any community, a lack of education, a lack of jobs, those sort of things are automatically going to contribute to crime. In the model of integrated policing, if you take something like education, how does the integrated police department work with the school system for the benefit of public safety?
Integrated policing recognizes that society is made up of a number of different people, and we got a lot of different functions that have to be met in order for the society to grow and to be productive. Integrated policing takes into consideration that we can't expect the teachers to be able to teach everything. If they have a disruptive student in the classroom, the student doesn't know how to read, and because he doesn't know how to read, the teacher calls on him, the student acts out because he doesn't know the answer and he doesn't want the people to really know that he doesn't know the answer, so he just acts out. The end result is he gets put out of school. He gets put out of class. Now he's in the streets, and he's walking around in the streets causing problems. He's no longer getting an education. That's a public safety issue. We need police officers that understand how to work with students so that we can give them the tools that they need so that they can be successful. We need to have police officers in the school as police educators, working with that student population that would otherwise be lost in the cracks because the teachers don't want them in the classroom because they're disruptive to the classroom. Police officers can serve a very good function in giving these people an alternative to where it is that they need to go, helping them, making them understand what it is that we need to do. It can't just all be about enforcement. It has to be about how do we work together to get better. And if we don't know how to do it ourselves, find the resources where we can. But we can't afford to let our children not be educated because they didn't learn something to begin with. See, we use that one size fits all factor again. So we teach everybody in the same way. We give them the same information in the same way. And if somebody didn't catch it the first time it went around, they're just lost. Well, if one thing builds on another and they get lost at the early stages and the second stage builds on the first stage and the third stage builds on the second stage, then they stay lost. They never catch up. We have to be able to analyze whether or not they got it in the first stage to begin with. And if they didn't, we need to make certain that they get it so that they can go on to the second stage and be prosperous. It works that way with everything. It's a question of policing being done in a way that the entire community recognizes that no one of us is as smart or as great as all of us. And it takes us all working together to ensure that the community is built in a way that's going to be beneficial to everybody involved.
You talked about a little bit earlier education. And I think that I want to make a point is that there are so many different police or so many police officers who get their educations or their degrees in criminology. And for the model of integrated policing, it's important that you have a diversity in what we're educated in, because just like you said, you can have police educators who go into schools and are able to teach students who would otherwise be disruptive and disrupt the educational process for everybody else. But those individuals who are taken, those police officers who go in, can absolutely help in that circumstance because they are educators themselves. Is that kind of what you're talking about when you talk about police educators?
It really is. It's understanding that we're all going to have certain functions, and we're going to have specialists in some areas. So you may have a police officer that's not just a police officer, but working in the school, so not just a resource officer, but an actual educator, because they have an opportunity to meet some of those kids that are falling through the cracks and give them some help that they wouldn't otherwise get. And there are lots of mechanisms out there where if you have a person that has a degree in education, that they can help to teach those kids that are otherwise getting lost, that are falling behind, so that they can catch up and get back into the mainstream of schooling. It's a responsibility for us all. If we think that our only job is law enforcement, then we spend most of our time driving around looking at the stars and listening to the radio and not accomplishing much of anything. The fact of the matter is, let's stop driving around looking at the stars and listening to the radio and get involved with the people. You can do that in a simple way as we use the park walk and talk idea. Get out of your car, walk into the neighborhood, interact with the students, interact with the parents, interact with the people in that neighborhood so that they know who you are and they know what you're about. If we were doing that, you would find that we wouldn't have the problems that we have in the minority communities. They feel neglected. They feel hopeless. You know, we blame all of the crime problems that we have on lack of education and lack of jobs, no money. And I would tell you, poor people know how to abide by the law. And many poor people do abide by the law. So just the fact that they don't have any money doesn't mean that they're going to become criminals. In fact, they don't become criminals because they still have something that some of the other people don't have. They maintain a sense of hope. They maintain the idea that one day we'll be able to come out of this, we'll be able to do better. So it's important for us to recognize that we can't keep blaming the crime in underprivileged neighborhoods, in minority neighborhoods, on lack of jobs and lack of education. I know some people that don't have any education that are good, law-abiding citizens. They don't have a problem. They're just poor. I know some others that don't have jobs. They don't have the things. They're just poor. They're uneducated, but they're good, law-abiding citizens. It's not the lack of jobs and the lack of education that's causing the problem. It's the fact that we've stolen all of the hope from the people in those neighborhoods, that we've left them with no dignity, no respect, and no hope. That's the problem. Give people hope, and you will find that it'll be easy to gain compliance.
So how does that giving of hope or helping to absolutely instill hope in a community, how does that mesh with the idea of integrated policing?
Can you say that again, please?
How do we give hope to those communities using the model of integrated policing? What does it look like?
First of all, I need to tell you that you can't give hope. We can't give people hope. What we can do is set up circumstances that are conducive to them being able to have hope. Hope will be spawned when they realize that there's a pathway to success. Hope will happen when they realize that there's a pathway to education. Hope will happen when they realize that they are respected, when they are revered, when they are considered to be productive members of a society as opposed to somehow a degradation and a plague on society. We need to provide the avenues for people to have hope by making certain that we give them the things that are necessary to maintain the dignity and respect that every human being should be afforded. Don't treat them like second-class citizens. Pretextual stops makes me believe I'm a second-class citizen. Don't treat me like I'm second-class and that I'm not worth something. If you treat me fairly, equitably, and consistently, I will be able to have hope. And if you work with me and work with the community so that we can find opportunities, the community will have hope, and they will, in fact, comply. You will find that if you are in any minority neighborhood, even the ones that's most crime-ridden, and the vast majority of people in those crime-ridden neighborhoods are good, law-abiding citizens. They just need an opportunity to show what it is that they can do and how much that they can provide to the community. But we can't afford to continue to treat every single person that we stop, every single person that we see that's a minority or in a minority neighborhood that happens to be poor, we can't afford to continue to treat them as if they don't count. They are full-fledged, honest-to-God Americans, and we have to do that. We have to treat them like full-fledged, honest-to-God Americans.
Something that comes to mind is after every police incident that has happened over the last 1 or 2 years, you also see videos come out from officers who are saying, I'm not like that. I police this way. I do this. I do that. What are some strategies for officers who are community-minded, have the best intentions for the community in their mind and in their job ability and function? What's some strategies for them if they work in a hostile police environment or a police system that is not conducive to their way of policing?
Well, I think that Sergeant Holland says find another department, you know, might be stretching it a little bit, because you can go from one department to another and find that they're all doing the same basic thing. So finding another department might not be the answer for that. However, the strategy that I would suggest is recognize that you've got to be humane. Policing of the future, integrated policing, is a more humane type of policing. And what we have to recognize is that the real benefits and the real progress that we're going to make in the future in policing is one of greater humanity. We need to start recognizing that driving around in the car doesn't put you in touch with the community. You got to get out of the car. You got to talk to people. That's a simple strategy. Park, walk, and talk. Get out. Talk with the people. Find out what the people need. Find out what it is that they have to have. Let them know who you are. And let them see your human side. They're not looking for you to walk around with a big red S on your chest, but like you're able to leap tall buildings. What they're looking for is someone that is, as you said earlier, empathetic. Someone that feels like they can see the plight. They can see the things that I'm going through, and that they can empathize with my position. And then take that back to the other people in the department and talk about it with them. Make them understand how the people you're dealing with every day, how good those people actually are. You see, if we walk around with that us versus them attitude, where the only good people in the world are cops, other cops, we do a disservice to everybody else that's out there. But if we start recognizing that there is no them, there's just us. So us versus them, there's no them. It's just us. And when we recognize that and we start talking that up, we'll do better. The fact is that policing has a culture, and that culture has been perpetuated over the years. We need to interrupt that culture. Instead of insisting on assimilation, we need to insist on synergy. We need to get officers in there that we can use as a part of a synergistic program to make us a better department. That means I'm not giving up something of who I am to become what you want me to be or to become more like you. But instead, I bring something special to the table that I can share with you that makes the two of us stronger together, that makes the whole department better, because we're not sharing everything that's exactly the same. You get a chance to see different ideas, different views, because I'm espousing different ideas and different views. And you accept those like I accept you. And once we learn to accept different perspectives, different ideas, different colors, we will then become better at what we do in this area of policing. It's when we expect everybody to be exactly like us and we insist that they become exactly like us that we do ourselves a disservice, because most people can't just become just like us.
I think that that question kind of segues in a little bit to what you and I discussed at dinner the other night, in that individual officers have very little power to change anything or impact a community when departments have taken policies that put them at odds with the community. So everything needs to be workable, for lack of a better term. You can't have an officer who goes on the street and says, I'm there for you, but the policies behind that officer and the things that they have to do based on individual policies of the department are against that. Say, I understand your situation, but ultimately I have to tow your car because my policy says that everybody who gets pulled over who has a suspended license needs to get towed. How can we rework police policies at a departmental level so that it allows officers to be empathetic? It allows officers to think on their feet. Because what I've, and we talked about this the other day, is that where we've gone in policing is police departments always trying to indemnify themselves versus the lawsuit, protect themselves from what may happen at the cost of what needs to happen. Well, do you have anything to say about that?
Sure. First of all, I would tell every police officer on the street, every single person that aspires to be a police officer, that your job is to always do that which you know to be good and right. If you have a policy that's outside of what you know to be good and right, then you need to talk to somebody about changing that policy. Always do that which you know to be good and right. So if we've got a policy that's putting upon the community, then you need to talk to the community. You need to let the people know that we need to get in there and change that. Somebody needs to help us change the policies. So if you know what the policy is, you know that this is causing you problems, let's get together. Let's go talk to the police chief and say, we need to change that policy. That's part of integrated policing, right?
Right.
Because the policy should be written with and for the people, not to do things to the people. But so often we just write policies that we can do things to people, and you're right, to indemnify myself. Stop thinking about indemnification and start thinking about what's right for the people. How do we serve the people? Now, if you compromise your values and your principles so that you can be in line with the policies, then my suggestion to you is get out of policing. I've been in policing, like I said, 37 years, and I have never compromised a principle. Now, that doesn't always serve me well, and I would tell you right up front, that I know that if I live to my principles, if I live to what I know to be good and right, I'm going to be at odds with somebody. I can guarantee it. And particularly as a police chief, I can tell you, if I go into a place, I have three ways that I can make people unhappy. I can do my job and I can do it well. And if I do that, I'm going to be happy. I can refuse to do my job or do it poorly. And if I do it that way, I'm going to make somebody unhappy. And if I try to walk that fine line right down the middle of the road and appease everybody, I'm going to make somebody unhappy. So I have to make a choice. How am I going to make you unhappy? I will do my job and I will do it well. And if you're unhappy with that, I can live with it. And that's the way you have to be. I have never taken a job that I'm not prepared to walk away from. And why? Because if you decide that you need to compromise who I am so that you can mistreat the community, I'm in the wrong place. I need to do something differently. I either need to take over because I'm good enough to get that job and take over and do what's right, or I need to go someplace else where I can make certain that the people are being treated better. Now, is that the easy way? Nah, that's the hard way. And nobody told you as a police officer it was going to be easy. And if you're looking for the easy way, you're in the wrong profession. You got to always do that which is good and right. And if you do that, the people will love you. I've been in departments where the people on the street will run up to the cops and give them a hug. And I don't know many places in this country where people are running up and giving cops hugs that are not their relatives. But I have worked in departments where we've cultivated the kind of culture and the kind of attitude that the people love their police officers so well that they run up to them and give them hugs. They know them. They know them by name. And they want to be around. If the cop turns on the red and blues behind them, they don't panic. Their heart doesn't skip a beat. Instead, they know that it's likely to be one of my friends stopping me to tell me that I'm doing something wrong. They also know that if the officer writes them a ticket, that they deserve it, that they know that they're being stopped for a legitimate reason and that what they're getting, they deserve. And most people can live with that. Most people don't have a problem with being held accountable for what it is that they've done. What we need to do is make certain that we're making that connection. And then recognize that in order to do effective policing, we have to change the notion in policing that police officers don't have to be accountable. If we as the people have to be accountable, the police have even a greater responsibility for being accountable. And if you do it wrong, accept your punishment. And if you've done it right, accept the accolades. But respect and accept the fact that if you're doing it wrong, you need to be held accountable, because otherwise the system will not work. You have to be trusted. And if there's no way that you're going to be held accountable for what you do, nobody's going to respect that.
We have about 10 to 15 minutes left in the show. I'm going to let Sergeant Holland ask a question, then I'll follow up with a few questions.
You talk about police accountability. If you look at what's happening today in society all across this country, police officer does something wrong and immediately you have police unions who step in to protect that officer. How do you see police unions as an entity in the model of integrated policing?
Well, recognize that a union is made up of a collection of people. Union in and of itself doesn't mean a thing. It's made up of a collection of people. And if you get the people that have the wrong idea, then the union can do things as a collective that are inappropriate and that don't serve the community well. Fact of the matter is, if we are good cops, the union of good cops would ensure that the bad cops are held accountable for what it is that they do. If, in fact, the union is not made up of good cops, but happened to be made up of bad cops itself, and it's all about protectionism, then the union will try to protect those officers. And we see that all together too often. And why? Because it's that us versus them thing. But that's why the people, in large part, don't trust you. Because you, as an individual citizen, will be held accountable. And if you do something wrong, they will tell you in a minute, we are going to bring you to justice. But the same rhetoric is not used when you see a police officer do something wrong. We're going to give him every benefit of the doubt. We're going to make certain. One of the things that irritates me more than anything is we can see a video of a police officer killing someone that's clearly not an immediate, imminent threat to them. And we will accept that the officer said, well, you know, we didn't see everything that happened before, you know, or everything that happened after. So we've got to really look at this thing and we got to take our time and investigate it. And those investigations can last for years. But it's an amazing thing that if I see on video a citizen doing something wrong and we've got the cops with the video, that same cop will tell you, got the video right here. You can see exactly what he did. He's not going to argue that you didn't see what happened before the video came on or you didn't see what happened after. They're going to argue the video says it all. Well, how can we have it both ways? How can it say it all when it happens to be a member of the public? But, hey, you can't look at that video and believe what the video says because you don't know everything that happened. I do know that it doesn't make any difference what the person happened to do before. If he is now compliant, you do not have the right to use excessive force on him. So it doesn't make any difference. Rodney King driving down the street, he's racing at high speeds. And for those people that don't know who Rodney King is, Google him. The fact of the matter is, Rodney King driving down the street, I don't care that he was going at breakneck speeds. I don't care that he was driving faster than the cops wanted. And when they stopped him, if he is complying, you do not have the right to beat him. There were 26 cops standing around watching Rodney King get beat unmercifully by a handful. And they took no action to stop what was going on. But they will argue that they were all good cops. I will argue that no, they're not. A good cop would not have stood there and watched that happen. Good cop would have taken action to stop the inappropriate battery that was going on to this person. That's what we swore to do. And we cannot, as police officers, abuse people and think that because we have a badge and a gun that it's legitimate. And we as a public need to hold those police officers accountable. And just because it didn't happen to your son or your daughter doesn't mean that you can approve of it tacitly or approve of it openly by saying as a grand juror, I don't see anything wrong. Because one day it might happen to you. And it may be wrong to you. And then if you've gotten in the habit of accepting the grand jury's argument that they didn't see anything wrong, there may not be anything wrong there either. Fact of the matter is, we got to use the same standards for our police officers as we use for the public. We, as police officers, have a greater responsibility to do that which is good and right. And knowing that we have the ability to use force in order to gain compliance, we have a greater responsibility to be very judicious in the amount of force that we choose to use in any circumstance. recognizing clearly that an excessive use of force, an unnecessary use of force, violates every tenet by which we swore to uphold, as police officers.
For the last few minutes, I want to talk about civil unrest and protest. How does integrated policing handle those situations? And give me some examples from your career as a police chief.
Well, let's take some simple things. Integrated policing takes into consideration that you have a constitutional right to free speech. You have a constitutional right to assemble. And as police officers, we have an obligation then to ensure that if you want to demonstrate, that we protect you in your right to demonstrate, or your right to assemble, your right to free speech. Now, some police officers will argue that you can only do that in a way that we tell you that you can do it. So we're going to prescribe for you exactly how you go about exercising your right to free speech. And I will tell you, then how is that exercising your right to free speech if it has to be done according to the rules that you have now established? The fact is, if I need to get my point across, sometimes I need to do things in a way that's going to get the point across, and it might not be in quite the way you want it to be done. But as police, because I have the right to demonstrate and to assemble and to speak freely, you've got an obligation to ensure that I can do that safely. Now, if we decide that we're going to have a parade, the police will block off the streets so that a certain segment of the population is allowed to have their parade march down the street. So now if we get a group of people that didn't apply for a permit but decided that they should walk down the street so that they can demonstrate, what as police should we do? Well, most police officers would tell you, we need to stop that. We need to take that street back because that's our street. And I would tell you, stop. These are your citizens. These are people in your community. Help them to demonstrate in a way that allows them to get their point across without injuring the public. Do we know how to redirect traffic? Absolutely. So redirect some traffic. Do we know how to block off an intersection to make certain that people don't get hurt? Absolutely. So block off the intersection. Work with the people, not against the people. Work for the people, not against the people. Recognize that your job is to do things with and for the community, not to the community. And if you don't agree with the rhetoric that that particular group is putting out, it doesn't matter. You don't have to agree. Your job is to take care of them, not to agree with them. Free speech means that there are going to be times when people are going to say things that you don't like. Civil disobedience means that there are going to be times when the public do things civilly that disobey the law. And we have to recognize that that should be admired. If you think about the greatest demonstration in the history of America, you pretty much get right down to the Boston Tea Party. Do you think that the king thought that them throwing tea off of that ship was a good thing? That them refusing to pay taxes was a good thing, or was that civil disobedience? But we will point that out every time. Oh, Boston Tea Party, this is America doing what? America rebelling against the doggone kingdom that they were supposed to be in support of. But that's what civil disobedience is about. Did they get the point across? Ultimately, they had to. But they had to use force to get it done. Now, I'm not advocating the use of force to change things, but I am advocating is that we understand that civil disobedience in and of itself is not a bad thing. Civil disobedience just means that today I'm walking down the middle of the street and tomorrow I won't because I recognize that the law says I shouldn't walk down the middle of the street. But if I'm walking down the middle of the street and there's 100 of us walking down the middle of the street today, you as a police officer should not take it upon yourself to try to arrest 100 people because they're walking down the middle of the street. Find a way to help them do what it is they need to do safely, because they're still citizens of the city. They pay taxes. Those are their streets. They're their roads. And yes, it may be a little inconvenience for some other people at the moment, but you know what? That's the nature of democracy. It's not always convenient for everybody. So you deal with the minor inconvenience and you let the people have the say that they need to have. Stop trying to control. Remember, control is an illusion. Learn how to manage. So I don't need to control the demonstration. I need to manage it. Now, Officer Shaw asked me to give an example, and I'm going to give you a simple example, something that you can relate to. Back when I was a chief of police at the University of New Mexico, the university decided it was going to put up a bookstore, and it was going to put up a bookstore in an area that had a lot of trees and a very green, nice park-like area that people liked. And there was a group of people that decided, we do not want you to put a bookstore in that area. We don't want you to cut those trees down. We want those trees to stay up. And so they climbed up in the trees and chained themselves to the trees. And the administration went crazy. They got on the phone, they called me and said, get those people out of those trees. And I went, why do you want me to get the people out of the trees? They said, well, they don't belong there, you know, and they're demonstrating. We don't want, I said, but wait a minute. There's nothing illegal about climbing a tree. We don't have a statute. We don't have an ordinance to say you cannot climb a tree. It's a park, and the park is open. You know, now, when it closes, you could say, well, they're in after hours. I said, but so what? Let's say that it gets after hours and these people are still in the trees. Why are we trying to force them out of the trees? Well, we have to build a bookstore. I said, but you're not building it today. You're not trying to break ground today. All you're trying to do is force these people out of the tree. Why do that? How about you let me handle this the way I would handle it? And he says, well, you understand, Chief, that we need to have that park clear. I said, don't worry about it. When it comes time to have the park clear, it will be clear. But let me deal with it my way. So what was my way? I had my officers go out and buy some soft drinks, buy some donuts and some cold cuts. We bought some, started making sandwiches. We took all that stuff over into that park area where the people were. And we told them, look, there's food over here. You can come down here and you can get food. And by the way, you can come out of that tree, go over here and get yourself some food, and then you can go right back up in that tree, and that's okay with me. It's all right. You can do that. You can come out of that tree, you can walk across the road, and you can use the bathroom, and then you can come back, and we'll let you go right back up in that tree. And if you want to change yourself in, go ahead. Tell me how I can help you do what you need to do. And what did they want? They wanted to be heard. That's all. They wanted to be heard. So when I asked them what you wanted, they told me, we want to be heard. And I said, well, who do you want to hear you? We want the media to take a look at us. I said, you know what? Let me help you like this. This is what we're going to agree to. We will agree that at some point, everybody needs to come out of these trees because they're going to cut the trees down and they're going to build a bookstore. We know that that's going to happen. Although you're working through the courts, and I applaud you for that, continue to work through the courts. And if you get a court injunction, no problem. You get to save the trees. If you don't, the trees are going to come down. But let's understand this. In the meantime, you can come up in the tree. You can get out of the tree. You can go get something to eat. You can go to the bathroom. Everything is going to be done the same. Now, when it comes time to get out of the trees, if you haven't gotten an injunction, then I'm going to ask you to leave the trees. But let's figure out how we do this so that your people don't get hurt, my people don't get hurt, and everybody gets what they need. Now, you say you want to be heard. I'm going to help you get heard, and this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to call every single media outlet in the city, in the state, and let them know that we're holding a press conference at the time that you're going to come out of those trees. And then you can tell me how you want to come out of the tree. You can come out voluntarily. You can climb down yourself. Or if you say, nope, I don't want to climb down myself, I want you removed, I will remove you. But we will talk about how we do that in a way that it doesn't jeopardize your safety and it doesn't jeopardize the safety of the officers that have to help you out. We had one woman that was in the tree that had a real serious bone problem. And she was prone to having her bones break with very little effort. So she told us, well, I'm up here and I'm protesting because I believe, but I do have this bone condition, you know, so how can you help me? I said, look, this is what we do. We get a cherry picker and we bring that bucket over here and we raise it up. And we allow you to come out of the tree and walk into the cherry picker, and then we will bring you down to the ground. Now, if you don't want to walk to the area that we're going to hold the press conference, we will pick you up and carry you. But we will do that in a way that it doesn't jeopardize your safety and security, doesn't jeopardize the safety of security officers. We negotiated through every single point how we were going to do this. And the leader of that organization talked to everybody else about how they were going to do it. And when it came time to come out of the trees, they came out of the trees. Peacefully, quietly. Some people wanted to be arrested, so we arrested them. But we arrested them humanely. We arrested them without taking their dignity and respect. And we let them go and talk to the media before we put them in and booked them. The fact of the matter is, we worked with them. Now, there's always going to be an outlier. So expect that even in the best of conditions, somebody's going to challenge the system. So we had one guy that decided he was not coming out of the tree. He's about 60 foot up in a tree right at the corner of that park. So everybody else is out of the trees. They've had their press conference now. Everybody has moved on, and this one guy up in the tree refuses to come out. So I get the cherry picker, and I go up the 60 feet, and the cherry picker and I look at him eye to eye. I said, okay, didn't we have an agreement that we were going to do this? And he says, well, you had an agreement with them. You didn't have an agreement with me. I said, okay, well, what are you trying to accomplish? I don't want them to cut down the trees. I said, okay, well, I'm just going to ask you to do something simple for me. I want you to look around. Look around at all those trees down there that you're trying to save. Look around and look at where you are. He's at the corner, in one corner of that park, 60 feet up in a tree. I said, now, do you really think that you in this tree right here are going to stop them from cutting down every other tree in this park? Really? And how long can you do this? How long can you stay up in this tree? So you're doing something now, you've set yourself up for failure. But I'm going to give you an honorable out. You see, you're still trying to get an injunction. So I'm going to tell you, continue on with the injunction. Work with the people to try to get an injunction. That's your right. If you don't get the injunction, though, they're going to start cutting down the trees. But I'm going to do something else for you, because they can't cut down every tree at once. They can only cut the trees down one at a time. So how about I do this? You come out of that tree, and while you're still working on your injunction, when they get ready to cut down the trees, I'm going to let you pick which tree they cut down first. So we've got some dead trees out here. Let them cut the dead trees first. So they cut the dead trees. That's not hurting anybody. You get to pick. And then when you get finished with the dead trees, let them cut down the trees that are in bad shape and that are dying. But and then when they get finished with those, then you can start choosing the trees that are healthy. But you get to choose the trees that they cut first. How about that? And he was like, that'll work. We'll keep working on our injunction and we'll do that. And he came out of the tree. Now, he had a crowd of people around him at the bottom cheering him on. But he had something he could tell them, because I gave him an honorable way out. What did it cost us to let him pick the trees that get cut first? It didn't cost us a thing. Didn't cost us anything at all. But it gave him the dignity and respect that he needed to save face and to come out of that tree. And he came out of the tree with me and that cherry picker right then. End of the story. It was called Protest of the 90s. Because we're not fighting each other. We're not adversaries. We're advocates. My job is to help you do what you need to do safely and securely without hurting you or anybody else. Did we accomplish that? Sure. Now, that's a very simple analogy, but it works in much more complicated circumstances. The fact of the matter is, we had no fights. We had nobody with broken bones. Nobody that claims excessive use of force. We did have people arrested, but they were arrested on their terms. They were charged with appropriate charges, so we didn't charge them like they wanted to be charged. We charged them with the appropriate charges, but they were very happy to have done what was done. So they were happy to be arrested. And at the end of it, they all thanked us. They thanked all of the cops that happened to be around, and the cops and the people made friends. Those people that had been demonstrating were now friends of the police. And every time you saw one of them after that, they made certain that they let you know just how much they appreciated you as the police, because you're working with us, not against us. Even though the trees were still cut down, even though the bookstore still went up, we didn't create any enemies. We created friends, and we solved the problem without confrontation.
All right, Chief. Well, I want to thank you for being on the show. Can you tell them how they can get the book, The Injustice of Justice, and how they can get in contact with you?
Well, you can go on Amazon.com. Type in The Injustice of Justice, it'll pop up, and you can buy it right there online. And you can get it on your Kindle, or you can get it any way that you like it. I think that, of course, since I wrote the book, I think that there's some good stuff in it. But it's written so that the average person hopefully won't get too bored reading it. It's written more as a story than it is as a dissertation on how to do policing. Fact is, though, we've got to do policing better, and it starts with the people. It doesn't start with the police.
By the way, for all you wondering, that true story is not in the book.
No, it's not.
All right, Chief. I want to thank you for being on the show. Thank you, Ray. Tuesday night, we have Dr. Reuben West. He works with Les Brown. Les Brown isn't a doctor, but he works with Les Brown. He's a motivational speaker, and our subject will be This Far by Faith, using faith to get to where you need to be in life. Thank you for attending the show.